Over to Gabby, your moderator.
Should still be being shared, and you should see me and my clock and my flag.
Okay, can you hit start sharing?
Oh, sorry about that.
Okay, thank you. So I'm moderating the second half of the session with Pearl's help in the chat box, and I'd like to start by introducing Stephen Darmes. We're very privileged to have Stephen with us tonight, and it would take me way too long to give an introduction to Stephen that does justice to him. So I'm just going to put a little link in the text box there. Hopefully I'm going to get this right. If you want to look up more about him. I'm sure that many people in the room already know Stephen from his daily online newsletter called OL Daily. He's a prolific blogger, and he specializes in the field of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. And he has thousands of subscribers to his blog, including me and several colleagues at the Media Zoo here. Stephen actually works for the National Research Council of Canada as a senior researcher, and he's published numerous articles, and he's a popular speaker at conferences and events around the world. One of the things that Stephen has mentioned in blogs and various events over time is his belief in the value of writing longer, deeper, more provocative, and more challenging blog posts. And I'm looking forward to hearing him extend that argument to the concept of the lecture today. So to balance out the discussion that
Hello, everyone, and I'm pleased to be able to speak to you today from beautiful Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, where it's just getting on to mid to late afternoon. We've got some clouds in the sky. The rain has stopped, finally. And I've been enjoying...
Sorry, Stephen, I have to interrupt you there. Your sound is very, very low. Can you try again?
Okay.
Stephen, we're not hearing you at all now.
This should be better now. Adjusted the mic volume inside the neck. It did seem to change on me. Oh, good. And I can see the little messages in the corner of the screen. That's helpful. They only stay for about 2 seconds, so I have to be looking in the corner of the screen to see them. But, oh, well, nonetheless. Let me just check. Audacity is recording. Not very high volume, as it never does. Let me also check, and let's see, the radio station is broadcasting, and if you're wondering what that's all about, I'm not simply broadcasting this lecture into the Adobe Connect room, but I'm also broadcasting it on web radio. The reason for broadcasting it on web radio is not everybody can get to an Adobe Connect session. Sometimes, you know, people are listening on whatever, it's late at night, they need to sleep to, and so I like to provide them with one of the lectures. My topic is the lecture must stand. In the advertising leading up to this session, I am hearing some background noises, like things shuffling, chairs moving around, you know. The topic had various definitions coming into it, and we did not actually have a topic statement that we were debating. And so I've devised my topic around the response to the proposition that the lecture must die. My response is basically the lecture must stand, that it must not die. And so I want to talk about this, and I want to draw this out. But, you know, let's put the case as forcefully as possible. I mean, this is the lecture, right? This is what we understand the lecture to be. Here we are sitting in the back room of the classroom, And the professor is droning on.
The most difficult thing here is where to start. Right, you've got to find the S.
And he's going to be a while before he gets to his topic here, so I'm not going to spend too much time listening to him. And you can see the people falling asleep in the class. And this is the thing that Donald Clark and James Morrison quite rightly are opposed to. I'm opposed to this as well. I want to be clear about that. There are so many instances of bad lectures in the world. Here we have some guy speaking to his slides, and I'm literally speaking to his slides. Look at the slide. We're never actually going to see the full picture of the slides here, but the text is too small to read. If I'm even sitting in the front row, I'm not going to be able to read that. The professor is showing no engagement whatsoever with the students, and as you can see, what's happening on the desk here is far more interesting than what's happening up on the screen. We've all seen this, haven't we? I'm surprised that Donald didn't play the video. Hopeless effort at engagement in the history of lectures.
Anyone? Anyone? Great Depression. Past the... Anyone? Anyone? The tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which anyone raised or lowered?
Well, I'm not going to inflict more of that on you than I have to as well. I admit, I agree. The world is full of bad lectures and bad lecturers. I would be foolish to deny that. I am not here to argue in defense of the bad lecture. What I want to do is what this guy wants to do anytime I'm exposed to a bad lecture. And I think this is a forceful demonstration of what every lecture needs, every lecture room needs, and that's a door out. It's interesting, the year or maybe 2 years before Donald Clark presented at the ALT-C conference, I presented it as well, and the theme of that conference was collaboration. And my main point at my talk at the ALT-C conference was that the people in the room were not required to sit there and listen to me, and that what made my lecture work was the fact that they could leave my lecture at any time. Well, Donald did do an eloquent denunciation of the lecture, a wonderful denunciation of the lecture. I'll just cue it here to... There we go.
Actually, in 2,000 years, I haven't found one single sentence that supports them.
Not one single sentence.
A lot of people put their minds to this problem. Nobody's saying the lecture is the way to do this. It's a default, it's a fossil, it's a medieval relic. For a start, why have 1 hour? We only...
Why indeed? Why have 1 hour? Nobody's defending the 1 hour lecture. This is not the point in debate here. And we looked at the problems that Donald has raised with the lecture, and we saw this set of problems raised at the ALT-C conference. We saw the same set of problems raised and some other problems raised today. There are things you can do incorrectly with a lecture. You can make the lecture too long. You can pad the lecture with useless and irrelevant content. You can force everybody to attend a lecture at a specific time in a specific place and punish them if they don't, and so on. You can put too much semantic content into a lecture. You can mess around with their episodic semantic memory, give them cognitive overload. You can set up a lecture so that there is no practice whatsoever, no authentic learning, authentic problems, as James Morrison said. You can set up entire courses so that there's no collaboration or no cooperation whatsoever. And of course, you can, as we're told, especially in physics, although the physicists I know would vehemently deny this, you can get people who are fundamentally not suited to public interaction up in front of a class publicly interacting. What is interesting, at the very end of the previous presentation, Renda came on and asked, did anybody define what a lecture is? And of course, in the preceding 1 hour, nobody had. And my observation of Donald Clark's argument especially is that it depends to a large degree on an equivocation of the meaning of lecture. Look even at the title, Don't Lecture Me, of his Alt-C presentation. That draws on the distinct meanings of lecture between a stern lecture versus a reading from a book or reading from notes, which was the definition he used today, versus an academic discourse. These are three very different things. My focus is on something like the academic discourse. Something like the academic discourse, because of course I'm not targeting the average academic discourse. I'm targeting the good academic discourse, because I'm defending good lectures, because it would be ridiculous to defend bad lectures. And nobody would expect me to do that. Which is the second equivocation, right? Most of what is being argued against here is the bad lecture. Well, I agree. Bad lectures are bad. Let's move on. But really, the title of the talk is, we should ban the lecture. Now, if the title had been, we should ban bad lectures, I'd say, we'll agree, we all agree, let's go home, we're done, right? But just because some bad lectures, or sorry, just because some lectures are bad, it does not follow that all lectures should be banned. And then we can take that even a step further, because we were presented with some empirical data about the effectiveness of lectures with no indication of whether the people listening to the lectures were engaging in effective listening practices. I'll tell you what I do. Sorry about the chimes. They always come in sometime during one of my talks. And somebody in the chat room just said babies and bathwater. Exactly. I tell you, when I go to a lecture, even one of Donald Clark's lectures, and even what he did today, I don't just sit there and passively listen to a lecture. That would be silly. What I've discovered from hard experience is if you just sit there and listen to a lecture, you fall asleep. So I blogged them. When I was in university, before blogging, I took notes. And when I got tired of taking your typical point form notes, I would actually recast the content of the lecture into a well-formed, with proper sentences and paragraphs and references and all of that, academic paper. And so my notes from my class lectures that I went to in university are now these little mini academic papers. The result being I can write an academic paper in a day. Maybe not a good one, but I can write one in a day. And then there's a third equivocation between lectures and only lectures. Would I argue that the only way we should teach people in university is the lecture? No, that would be ridiculous. Would I argue even that the default way that we should teach people in university is the lecture? Again, no. Nobody argues that. That's not the proposition. I think that it is widely accepted and understood in the field of education that we need to employ a multitude of educational practices. The question is, as we disassemble the traditional course, as we disassemble traditional education and rebuild it into something that we know works, does the lecture have a place? And my argument is, the lecture does have a place. That's the point that I'm making here. What is that place? Well, let's first talk about empirical evidence.
I will be your lecturer this term.
Let's look at a little real data. We talk about data. Let's look at some real data. Here's a lecture. It's a physics lecture. driest, most boring subject in the world. Sorry, Donald, but it's physics. Like, this lecture, the one we are looking at here, has 500,000 views on YouTube. If you... enough. It's physics. If you looked at YouTube, if you looked at the lectures from the TED videos and that, they have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of views. The evidence says people like lectures. So what do they like them for? I want to argue here that even though... Sorry, this is a wonderful picture of hammering nails because I needed something here. The argument here that... Okay, let's silence that to zero. Sometimes the videos don't always work. The argument that everything, to a hammer, everything is a nail is not an argument against nails. The argument that to a lecturer, everything is a lecture is not an argument against lectures. When I was in university, I did a bunch of things. And one of the things that I did on a reasonably regular basis was to organize demonstrations, much like the demonstrations that are now taking place in Britain. We'll keep the sound to a minimum on that. Organized mass demonstrations against tuition fee increases. And one of my greatest demonstrations, well, mine, it was ours, was a group of 5,000 of us, which is a significant crowd, considering it was Edmonton, Alberta, which is a smallish northern Canadian city, and the temperature outside was minus 30 degrees. And we got everybody together, we made sure we had the paramedics on hand because it was minus 30 degrees, and we marched across the bridge and we stormed the legislature and we had speeches, and we had placards, and we had the Minister of Education come out and address us, and people yelled at him, and it was all great. And after the end of that, somebody came to me and said, well, why did you do that? You didn't change anybody's mind. The government's still going to pursue the policy that it pursued. And if you looked at the evidence, if you do the empirical evidence the way Donald Clark did, 99% of all demonstrations fail to change anything. Oh, sure, maybe you'll overthrow a government like in Egypt. But most of the time, nothing happens. The government does what it's going to do. People get angry. Sometimes a window gets broken and everybody goes home. But it's the classic mistake of misunderstanding the purpose of the thing. The purpose of a demonstration isn't to get the government to change its mind. Everybody marching knows the government isn't going to change its mind. The purpose is to show power. The purpose is to show resolve. The purpose is for everybody in that demonstration to know that they are not alone. They're not the only ones going through this, they're not the only ones that are opposed to what's happening. The purpose of the demonstration is to create this community. So if you evaluate demonstrations on the basis of whether they produce change in the government, you're evaluating the wrong thing. And it doesn't matter how much evidence you have, you just haven't measured the right thing. Donald talked about the reading. The reading of text as being something absolutely horrible and unbearable. But, you know, it really does depend on the text and often who's doing the reading. Here we have Canadian actor William Shatner.
I'll say hello to Hosni.
Reading.
And the other thing that mystifies me is the VD experience. Said I'd always be a friend. Took an oath, I'm going to stick it out till the end. Now that it's raining more than ever, know that we still have each other.
Now, was that torture? Okay, maybe it was. But you get the point, right? Just the mere fact that somebody is reading something doesn't make it bad. What is the purpose of a lecture? Here we have lecturer John Stewart.
From us. Somewhere between the gold rush of easy internet profits and an arrogant sense of endless empire, we heard kind of a pinging noise, and then the damn thing just died on us. So I apologize. But here's the good news. You fixed this thing. You're the next greatest generation, people. You do this. And I believe you can. You win this war on terror, and Tom Brokaw's kissing your ass from here to Tikrit, let me tell you.
So that's John Stewart giving us a lecture in the form of the comedy stand-up routine. You know, there isn't really a distinction between the lecture and the stand-up comedy routine. The stand-up comedian is attempting to do the same thing as the lecturer. Find a point in common in the audience, bring it out, make people see themselves in a different way, and then make people laugh at themselves. It's about looking at the old thing in a new way. And all you have to do is change the point of view, change the perception. It's not about remembering facts. You know, you come home from a comedy session, yeah, maybe you didn't remember all the jokes, but that wasn't the point. Sometimes it's about putting a human face on the abstract. Here's Randy Pass. His
Make
last
me
hear lecture.
It's wonderful to be here. What Indira didn't tell you is that this lecture series used to be called The Last Lecture. If you had one last lecture to give before you died, what would it be? I thought, damn, I finally nailed the venue and they renamed it. So, you know, in case there's anybody who wandered...
Yeah, I know it's absolutely true that the best way to learn about something is by experience, but maybe you don't want to learn about terminal cancer by experience. You're going to have somebody tell you about it. You're going to have somebody put their human face on this very abstract fear. The lecture is about making a connection with an audience. Nobody knows this better than Barack Obama.
And yet we forget that. There's a lot of talk in this country about the federal deficit, but if we hope to meet the moral test of our times, if we hope to eradicate child poverty or AIDS or joblessness or homelessness or any of the other issues that were chronicled before I came on stage, then I think that we're going to have to talk more about the empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through somebody else's eyes.
Now, how are we going to do that without somebody standing up in front of us and telling us in a heartfelt and personal way what it feels like or what it seems like or how it went for them, what their reasoning was, what they wanted to do, what they hoped to do, what they feared? Yeah, you can create a team-building exercise, but, you know, there's no substitute for looking into Barack Obama's eyes and seeing the sincerity there. The lecture is about making a connection with the audience. The point of the lecture is to bring something out in the lecturer, how he or she thinks. Even James Morrison in the session leading up to this said, you know, there's nothing better than watching somebody working without a prepared script, maybe even without notes, watching them go through a reasoning process on the fly. And the greatest lectures are like that, where even if they're working from prepared text, you can see the nickels drop as they speak, and their voice begins to rise, and maybe there's a tremble behind it, and the feelings rush up, and you get that connection. Now, if you're just sitting there passively, not involved in the lecture, you're not going to get that connection. It depends on you, the listener, your involvement as well. But, you know, it's not all about dry data. It's not all about, did the subject register an increase in learning? Did the subject register an increase in motivation? The plural of data is not knowledge. And the data may show that lectures are not effective teaching tools, but the people know that this isn't true. Carl Sagan knew the value of a lecture.
Might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple.
The data says the earth is small. But the meaning of what it means to be small is what Sagan brings out in his lecture. And again, it's that meaning that is not going to be evoked through a problem-solving session or something like that. What is the idea of a lecture? What is it that we're up to with a lecture that we can't do in any other way? The famous theologian and lecturer Rudolf Otto talked about the numinous. He's talking about, you know, an imminent presence and not an imminent speaker. But the concept behind the idea of the holy nonetheless comes into play here. The numinous, he said, is a mystery, mysterium, that is both terrifying, tremendum, and fascinating, fascinans. He's speaking not about the nature of the numinous, but the nature of our response to the numinous. You don't consider a song to be a failure because you don't remember the words, or even because you didn't believe the message after the game. U2 is still U2. You still like U2 even if you don't want to save the world. It's this evoking of these three things that makes the lecture something that we can't do with a problem-solving session. Mysterium. Here's a TED video. It's plain data. Yeah, I know. But plain data can be presented in such a way as to capture our imagination. Look at this. This is economic data. Look at the excitement of this presenter. Isn't this interesting? Don't you wonder how these bubbles are moving, why they're moving, what makes them move?
The green down here, they still remain here. This is India. Indonesia is moving on pretty fast. And in the 80s here, you have Bangladesh still among the African countries there. But now Bangladesh, it's a miracle that happens in the 80s. The imam starts to promote family planning.
That happens in the 80s. A miracle. Tremendum. Nobody understood tremendum better than Winston Churchill.
As they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their...
Can you listen to this without feeling the force behind those words? Can you listen to this without the sense of awe that it must have inspired? What if you're on the other side of that channel and you're listening to one of these broadcasts and you're thinking of invading that island? And then there's fascinance. This amazing wonderment, this fascination, this allure of a subject that draws you in. Richard Feynman was one of the greatest at
this. What we are, where we're going, what the meaning of the universe is, and so on. Then I think you could easily become disillusioned and then look for some mystic answer to these problems. We're exploring, we're trying to find out as much as we can about the world. People say to me, are you looking for the ultimate laws of physics? No, I'm not. I'm just looking to find out more about the world. And if it turns out there is a simple ultimate law that explains everything, so be it. That would be very nice to discover.
Every one of these lectures, I want to play to its full length. And I had the pleasure, and believe me, it was a pleasure, of listening to these videos at their full length to pick out, you know, just the right spot to play as I was preparing for these talks. It's this sense of mystery, awesomeness, and fascination with the world, with our subject matter, with each other, that the lecturer evokes. Kill the lecturer? Did you say that to Martin Luther King? I'll have to do it that way.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together.
Now, would it have been more appropriate for Martin Luther King to get people to gather in small groups and go through a problem-solving exercise? Would it have made more sense for him to start with some icebreakers? Would it have made more sense for him to do anything other than lecture? Kill the lecture? You might as well kill the human spirit.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists.
And to hear the rest of that lecture, you're going to have to go listen to Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you for your time, everyone. I hope you enjoyed my response to the proposition that we kill the lecture.
Thank you, Stephen. Okay, it's over now to Donald and James, who can share the platform for a 10-minute response, and then general questions from the audience, comments, and Stephen, of course, can come back after that. So I think Donald's been writing a lot in the text.
Hi there. Yeah, I suppose a number of people were making comments here around definitions. I mean, I came into the bar doing not about TV, radio broadcasts, orators, professionals who had come to the top of their world, where you had unique skills. We're talking about the distribution of the lecture within tertiary education. And every day, hundreds of thousands of lectures are given worldwide, And that's my definition of a lecture. The standard one-hour pedagogic lecture delivered to groups of students in lecture rooms. Now, I actually agree with Stephen on a couple of things. I don't agree with banning even lectures in academic institutions wholly and utterly. For example, in China, there's a guy who gives crazy age lectures to 10,000 people at a time in football stadiums, charges $25 a pop. Fantastic. If you're going to lecture, lecture to millions, don't lecture to a small group. I think there's something about students being feeling they're part of something with high-end academics. But to be frank, if you looked at a distribution curve on the quality of lectures, you have this huge, huge mass in the middle where no learning is taking place. And I don't think that inspiration, that sort of gut feel I get when I looked at Martin Luther King or John Stuart or Winston Churchill, happens in that huge area in the middle of the distribution curve. I think students are bored. I think they're not listening, and many of them don't even turn up to future lectures. And therefore, we really need to define the domain here. I'm talking about the huge number of those one-hour lectures that take place with little or no formative feedback, where people have to sit for an hour. And of course, Steve was right. They all have a door. They have a cognitive door. They tune out all the time. You can see it. Yeah, I mean, you know, even in Professor Loon's lectures, he had 40% of his students didn't turn up for the final lecture. 40% dropout. And you can see it when the cutaways go up, the students, you can see sometimes they're bored, and he's a good lecturer. You know, it's just for an hour of constant physics. And actually, Loon makes many mistakes in his lectures, curiously. But it's not enough. He can't sustain it. The students can't stay, they can't keep the attention level up. And therefore, the whole thing sort of falls off. This is why MIT abandoned Loon's lectures.
Yes. Stephen, I really enjoyed your presentation. I think it's unfortunate, though, that we don't have a lot of Martin Luther Kings and the fellow who did the last lecture and so forth giving lectures in hour-long classes. I think that what Donald and I are saying in effect is that although most professors in higher education do use predominantly the lecture method for their classes, they are not engaging students. And I think that student engagement is a necessary factor in enabling students to develop the competencies they need to be successful in school and in life. And to develop those competencies, they have to experience them and get feedback from professionals like professors. And I think that that's the major argument that Donald and I are making. Certainly, lecture has a role everywhere, you know, certainly to introduce topics or projects or problems in summary and giving, feedback. But I don't think that we're certainly arguing that they shouldn't be the primary pedagogical technique that we use in college teaching.
Thanks, Jim. Stephen, do you want to have a quick response to those responses, and then I'll open it up to the floor? So while Stephen is speaking now.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I appreciate the responses. I did enjoy giving that talk, and I do enjoy sometimes getting into the spirit of the debate. So I think that where I am is probably closer to where Donald and James are, or more accurately, let me be more accurate. I think that Donald and James are more close to where I am than the position that they argued. Now, we have all agreed, and I stated at the outset, that we're not defending bad lectures. we all agreed that we're not defending the proposition that the lecture should be the sole or even the dominant form of learning. And we all agreed that there are some things, and you know, we could go through, we got even some more in this rebuttal from Donald, you know, the average bad lecture, the hour is too long, people lose engagement, etc. What I tried to do is address the question, is getting rid of the lecture the way to address bad lectures? And what I tried to do in my presentation was through some exemplary examples to show what we would lose if we got rid of the lecture. Yeah, I know, not everybody is Winston Churchill or even Randy Posh, although Randy Posh wasn't Randy Churchill for Randy Posh's last lecture. I don't know what that is. Somebody's rebutting by drum beat.
I think those of us who are not speaking and is typing. Is it me?
Anyhow, oh, they've stopped. Okay, good, we're back. What I wanted to do is show through exemplary examples what we would lose. And then pose the question, is the way to address the problems with lectures to get rid of lectures entirely? And I tried to draw out the idea that what is happening in a good lecture is not the transmission of content. I have never, ever argued that learning is about the transmission of content. And I think that educators are finally beginning to realize that education is not about the transmission of content, which, parenthetically, makes evaluations of education according to whether content was transferred a ridiculous task. The idea of a professor doing anything aside from pedagogical orchestration, which could be done by a robot or a teaching assistant, is to provide an example to the students, to provide an exemplar, to provide a paradigm, to show them what it is to be a physicist, what it is to be a chemist, what it is to be a civil rights leader. And the way to do that is not through these orchestrated pedagogies, because that's not how a physicist does physics. You want to draw out by seeing the person actually in practice doing whatever it is that they do, and then explaining why it is that they do what they do. And often the explanation in a good lecture comes as a surprise to the explainer. And the professor's own knowledge of his own discipline increases through the giving of the lecture. I give lots of lectures. I don't even have a teaching job. And the reason why I give lectures is because, well, twofold. First, I want to extend myself, to stretch myself, to understand my own discipline, my own thoughts, my own theories, my own understanding better. And I do that by giving lectures. And second, I want people to see what it is to be a theorist in this domain. And so I give them examples of me working on the fly. I gave a talk once, I gave a talk in South Africa, in Bloemfontein. And we did the world's first Skype cast of a keynote presentation. And it was a technical disaster. It all worked in the rehearsal, and it failed utterly during the actual talk. And so the first 15 minutes of the talk was all of us trying to solve the problem. But we left all of our mics open because, well, why not? And somebody came up to me after and said, the most interesting part of the presentation was watching you guys all try to solve the problem. He told me that even the experts have problems, which is really reassuring. And it showed me how you go about thinking through the problem. And that's what a good lecture is supposed to be. It's supposed to show the thinking in action. And the thinking in action involves a sense of mystery, involves a sense of tremendousness, involves a sense of fascination that I tried to evoke in my talk. And that's what we need to preserve. So rather than getting rid of the lecture, we should restructure the lecture. We should, as Donald very correctly suggested, ensure that the lectures are recorded, which is why I record all of my lectures now, at the suggestion of James Morrison, who suggested that I should record my talks and maybe we can make papers out of them one day. That never happened, but now I have like hundreds of recordings. Thanks. And we should have lectures, even cases where people read from text, have lectures where the lecturer is in some way stretching him or herself. And we should talk to people, encourage people to listen to lectures correctly and not to just sit there passively receiving, but to engage through the taking of notes, through the tweeting of tweets in a back channel. I have my own back channel system that I use during my lectures. I didn't use it here because you have a chat room. But, you know, I tell people, you know, I have three screens. One for the video of the presenter, one for the video of the slides, and one for the video of the back channel. Have these multiple things going on and have people engage. It's still a lecture. People are still listening to a speaker, but it's something more inclusive, something more engaging. So, yeah, I think the idea of throwing out the lecture because people do it badly is to give up on something that has served us very, very well through history, from the ancient Greeks through the practice of oration and rhetoric through to Cicero, through all of history to the present day. Oration still matters. The lecture still matters. And that is the proposition that I am trying.
Thank you, Stephen. Let me open this up to the audience now and see if anybody wants to take the mic. I see a hand up, and that is James. Okay, James, I'll let you have another word. But after that, anybody in the audience who wants to speak, you put your hand up by clicking on the little man at the top of the screen. Or is it a little woman back to front? We have.
I enjoyed your description of going through the thinking process, and then your Skype example of people exhibiting problem solving. I think what Donald and I are arguing is that thinking process and that problem solving should be taking place with students, with professors giving feedback on their problem solving and their thinking. There was a comment in the chats section earlier about how do you assess learning and when you're using projects and problem-based learning and so forth. And it's simply the product that students produce. Now they can develop portfolios, certainly electronic portfolios, of their projects and their problems. And that is a demonstration of their competency. Or lack of competency. You know, of course, it's hopefully professor-assisted competency because professors are giving feedback throughout the process of the development of a project or problem-solving exercise. But I certainly think that Stephen's made a good argument for interaction with lectures, and I would estimate that there are very few lecturers with Stephen's competency to manipulate so many screens at the same time in terms of having black channels and all those kinds of engagement technologies that he's using. He's using everything except clickers, it looks like. Anyhow, Engagement is certainly a key thing, and I think our argument, it's not really that you completely eliminate lectures. I think that lectures can be used to start off classes, and topics, and there's certainly, and it's certainly important for people to know how to give good lectures. That's essentially what Stephen, Donald, and I are doing here. We're doing presentation. And that's always important. But our argument is, in terms of the predominant strategies within the college environment, the more we can have students constructing knowledge themselves and giving feedback as to how they're doing it, the more likely we are to have them develop the competencies that they need to be successful.
Right. I think we've come to a point where we're all in agreement that nobody wants bad lectures, nobody's promoting bad lectures, but there is a bit of a fuzzy space as to whether the solution to that is to kill the lecture completely, to provide staff development, as Lindy is suggesting, to...
Yeah, I just wanted to take a slightly stronger proposition before we burst out into this cloud of agreement where nobody disagrees about anything. I think there's one danger that maybe missed out here, which is something that Eric Mazur at Harvard caught when he tested his students and found that those very smart kids actually had an Aristotelian view of physics after a full term of lecturing on Newton's three laws. And that's because they had slavishly followed the maths and hadn't really understood the physics. And the danger here, which I'd like to point to in this big mass of lecturing in the middle, is that the professors think they're teaching, they don't think they're doing what Stephen pointed towards, the professors think they're teaching and the students think they're learning. And neither are doing teaching and learning. They're doing something else. Now, if that's the proposition, we could probably solve Stephen's problems, and I would agree with this, by having the academic at the beginning of the year give one inspiring lecture about what it's like to be a physicist, how he got there, point them towards the books he's read, or she's read, and so on. But to give these long 3-lecture-a-week courses is something entirely different. You are saying you will learn in this course from my lectures. You're not doing what Stephen says. You're actually... It was a very good blog post, I forgot who wrote it recently, saying it's like pseudo-teaching. You know, both sides think teaching and learning is taking place, but it's actually not. Now, if we were honest about that, I think we would reduce the number of lectures, they'd be very different, there certainly would be a lot fewer, and we'd have other pedagogic techniques in their place.
Donald. Lindy's asking questions about timetables and a one-hour slot for 500 people simultaneously. I think that could take us down the road of asking whether timetables are and 500 people slotted into a single hour, whether that is the way to go in the first place. There was a comment that came up much earlier in the session that didn't get followed up on, but I think it came up while Stephen was talking. And that was from George, who said that, that teaching is about being emotionally attuned to your audience. So the implication there being that whether you're lecturing or not, if you're emotionally attuned to your audience, your teaching will be effective. I'm just looking at the time now, and I have a little poll for you at the end that Simon put up now. And the poll is, I'm going to ask you the question. Here's on the screen. Question is, kill the lecture. And I've given everybody a cop-out if you want it. Yes, no, or undecided. So, Donald, James, Stephen, you're welcome to vote as well. We won't know if you've changed your mind because it's anonymous voting. we can see, can we? Okay, if you want, we won't go down that road. It's a close call. It was a close call. Looks like no is ahead of yes, and there is one undecided person in the room. Anyone else still want to? Oh. Anyone else still want to vote? Donald, your microphone is picking up your typing. Unfair poll. No one said kill it completely. Okay. Good point. All right. We need to wrap up this debate now. The lecture must die was the original question. But just a little. Okay. I would very, very much like to thank all our contributors and participants, Donald, James, and Stephen, for your time and for your very engaging lectures on the subject of the validity of the lecture or not. And to thank all the audience for the participation in the text box. And to thank the support people here in the zoo. The next session, for those of you who are staying on for that, will start in approximately 3 minutes. So I'll give half. Oh, sorry, there's 30 minutes, and apparently that's lunchtime in Seattle. So I'll give.
Okay. Fine, yeah. I mean, I didn't. I suppose the proposition was not to kill all public speaking, all oratory, all politics, but it certainly would be a great boon for mankind if yet another generation of students weren't put through what I went through and what I hear most students who graduate even now get put through, which is the tedium and the illusion that they're learning through lectures, because they get very little else. Many courses are based entirely on lectures, with very little in the way of formative feedback other than scribbled notes on their submitted essays. And that's a tragedy, and I think it will be bad for students and bad for the future of higher education if we continue with that old model. Thank you.
Concur with what Donald said, and I think I concur with the argument that lecture should not be the predominant mode of instruction in colleges and universities. There's certainly a role for lecture, but it's not to be the predominant role. The predominant role is to design active learning strategies that students construct knowledge and learn in that process with the professor's critique and guidance. I would like to address a question that Lindsay wrote in terms of large classes, because one of the justifications for lecture is that if you have 500 students, you got a lecture. It's the only way you can handle it. There is a Pew Foundation program that's administered by Carol Twigg, and I forget exactly the name of the program. If you Google her name, you'll get to it. It's academic restructuring or something like that. But it essentially is a way of handling these extremely large introductory classes of like 3,500, where you used to have 30 or 40 professors handling them in classes of 25 or 35. One professor would do it, but would do it with a team, an instructional designer, a person for evaluation, and a whole slew of graduate students, where essentially the professor was the designer of with an instructional designer's assistance of a class, which is very interactive, but it's interactive primarily with the graduate students, and is very problem-based and active learning-based even though it's a very large class. She's got a whole literature of case studies of where this has been used, primarily to cut the cost of education, but she also has evidence that students are learning more in these extremely large classes with this particular paradigm of instruction, which is active learning, actually, in a large class. That's it.
Thank you. Again, I certainly enjoyed the debate. And I think, first of all, it shows the importance of defining your question and defining your position up front. I think we would have involved ourselves in a very different debate had the opening position been something like bad lectures should die, or the role of the teacher should be to promote active learning. And you know, I think there are interesting discussions to be had around those areas. You know, both of you more or less sort of argue now then that instead of lecturing, what the instructor should be doing is designing these active learning strategies. And we'd still have a debate on that. George Siemens and I have been running these online connectivism courses with very large audiences. Lectures have formed a component of these courses, and it's important that they do, because they serve as a keystone around which everything else revolves. But what we haven't been doing is orchestrating some sort of pedagogical process. Because, you know, having the professor orchestrate a pedagogical process, as I said in a talk just yesterday, is almost as bad as having a professor read to you. It's the professor managing the learning for you, when really, as a learner, what you should be doing is managing your own learning. And this is what we try to encourage in the connectivist courses. So I think there are other topics related to this topic that would also serve as the basis for fruitful and interesting discussion. And I hope that we can direct our attention toward those discussions and toward a wider view of what learning is. It's not just as this, not just as that, but what sort of combinations.
Stephen, and thanks for the great ideas for next year's conference. We'll be following up there. A quick answer to Lindy's question, because I was in one of the multi-user online courses, and there were over 2,000 people in it. That was the first one. I'm not sure if the second one had more people. So thanks, everybody. And we'll move on now to the 25-minute break, I think. And after that, my colleague from Beyond Distance, Therese Bird, will be speaking about her experience of using iTunes U at the University of Leicester for open educational resources. She's gathered some really interesting information via Twitter predominantly about how people out there are using iTunes U resources, what they're saying about it, how they're engaging with them. So I would highly recommend the next session. So for now,